Alright.
I'm not an enforcer. I'm more like a
fixer.
Exactly.
Oh, and
I
it's
have to convince a certain person.
Marina Bakarin is the coach.
Oh, cool.
Betrayal's a funny thing. Its very nature is to catch you unaware.
You ever heard a Ring doorbell?
So you look at this, and it's like all the locations are, you know, the woods somewhere, these generic neighborhoods, and you just know they filmed this in Serbia, New Zealand, some random place with tax write-offs.
Turned on your own.
You ought to get out of Biloxi, Charlie.
That's what everyone keeps telling me.
What accent is he doing? Is that New Orleans?
I'm going with or without you.
With a staggering body count, says Deadline.
You got a bullet.
You, not breathing.
And how are you gonna do that?
I'm doing it.
But seriously, what is that accent?
You know, you really ought to start thinking about an exit plan. What are you waiting for? Pull the trigger, Charlie. Giving over your head.
I don't like loose ends.
You can tell it's actually not that action-packed.
Yeah, we're just seeing clips from the same, like, three scenes over and over again.
I'm looking forward to meeting number one.
Wait, that's the title?
Fast Charlie.
Fast Charlie, and the fast is italicized for emphasis.
So, for those who don't know, we just watched the trailer for the brand new Pierce Brosnan thriller, Fast Charlie. It looks like this really low-rent action movie that's kind of somewhere between Steven Seagal and Liam Neeson. And what really tickled me, I'll watch anything with Pierce Brosnan. I'm a Pierce head. I love him. He's probably my favorite Bond. But yeah, what really tickles me about this one is, yeah, what the fuck is that accent that he's doing? Like, he sounds like Larry Flint.
The accent is British guy trying and failing to do an American accent.
Is it like New Orleans? I don't know. Anyway, welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with...
Yeah, Luke Savage, starting fast and loose on this one. Well, look, speaking of New Orleans and kind of Cajun themes... Those came in on our last episode when I talked about that Scooby-Doo straight-to-video movie that scared the hell out of me as a kid.
Neither of us were able to identify what it was.
No, but dozens upon dozens of you were, and
yeah,
I don't know.
You can stop replying.
No. Don't listen to Will. Don't be discouraged. I loved it. I loved getting messages all day yesterday from people who were like, oh no, it was Scooby-Doo Zombie Island, and that part with the mask getting torn off or like failing to get torn off, that scared the hell out of me and my brother too.
It's great when you're social media feeds are 50% atrocity footage and 50%, it was Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island.
Yeah, genuine horrors like the Scooby-Doo episode where the monsters were real.
So to kick things off on this episode, I just want to hash over, hear your thoughts on an article that I was seeing get passed around on the feed with kind of an apocalyptic tone from some of the people passing it around. This new existential threat to the left flank, the small left flank of the United States Congress. There was an article in Slate called "The Squad is About to Fight for Its Political Life. The War in Gaza Has Set the Stage for a Huge Primary Battle in 2024.
This is by Alexander Salmon, who, if people aren't following him, one of the best writers on U.S. politics today, formerly of The Prospect.
One of the biggest, bitterest, and most expensive political battles of the 2024 election cycle has emerged. The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, also known as AIPAC, of course, is planning to go all out to knock the famed Squad out of office. So the article goes on to talk about how they're targeting Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib.
Cori Bush, I assume.
The usual suspects with a $100 million blitz. Big TV ads and big high-profile TV slots up, you know, two times, three times from what they spent during their last disastrous attempt to unseat these congresspeople. Big, 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 big money up against candidates who are largely small donations, grassroots, in a cycle when political donations are down. And I'm raising this because I'm not certain to what extent to be concerned about this. Because for years and years and years, an organization like AIPAC has sort of been treated as, oh, you can't cross this. They're too powerful. They're too unscrupulous. They can do anything. But over the last month, I would say propaganda efforts on behalf of the Israeli government in the war have been bad. they've been poor.
Really? You don't think these videos they're rolling out that are like instantly debunked? Like, do you see the one today about the Hamas tunnel where it's just like people quickly identified it as being like a video from Sweden?
This has been, you know, one time when the community notes function on Twitter has been useful. Every single one of these official Israel accounts is something like, look at the fraud happening in Gaza, and the community note will be like, oh yeah, this is
a Lebanese film that was about Gaza. And yes, all these people are actors because it's a movie.
And, you know, messaging has been, shall we say, flawed at every step of the process where, I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, where it's like, oh, we don't bomb hospitals. Actually, Hamas bombed their own hospital. But if we did bomb the hospital, we had to because
Hamas was there.
Hamas had tunnels.
Also, we were rescuing hostages. Actually, there were no hostages there. And it was just because we think there's tunnels underneath.
And actually, we did invade the hospital. Look at these guns that we got at the hospital. And there are tunnels, but we're not going to show them to you yet. And here's a rendering of what the tunnels might look like. The messaging has not been good, and a bit of an easy target at this point, but Alan Dershowitz had a live stream yesterday with the title, "When Attacking a Hospital Can Save Lives," which I would say, not the best messaging.
A great messenger, though. I think you'd agree. Well, I think the burden of the question you're putting to me is, how worried should we be about AIPAC targeting, you know, the handful of left-wing members of Congress who are openly criticizing it and openly criticizing Israel's war in Gaza? And, I mean, I don't know what Alex thinks, and it's early, but my instinct at this point would be, I don't think that AIPAC is necessarily very successful in a context like this. I think that a lot of its effectiveness comes in the form of soft power and deterrence. So they're able to stop people winning primaries in the first place. Like, they defeated Nina Turner, or played a huge role in defeating Nina Turner, I think, in both of her attempts to get into Congress. But even then, I think she only lost quite narrowly. And that was with, you know, yeah, massive ad buy, lots of leafleting and, you know, TV ads and such. I think that all of these members will be able to use the fact that AIPAC is targeting them in order to fundraise, in order to campaign. And I think that, you know, we're increasingly coming up against the limits of what propaganda can achieve in terms of swaying public opinion, no matter how much money is behind it.
I'm sure you've been seeing these CNN reports, you know, these video pieces of embedded journalists in the field, you know.
I haven't been watching those, honestly.
But you see them as you scroll past, and, you know, these exclusive, I mean, they're exclusive because so many of the actual journalists have been fucking killed. But they're exclusive, you know, ride-alongs with the IDF. And it's funny, whenever I catch a glimpse of them, you'll see, you know, some journalist with their little pith helmet on, riding in a tank, surrounded by nothing but decay and death and rubble. Just a gray, bleak, you know, hellish landscape. You know, at the end of the day, it's kind of hard to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. The images speak for themselves. You saw that photo that was going around of the IDF soldier holding the pride flag surrounded by nothing but rubble and death. It's absurd. It's like if Paul Verhoeven put that in a movie, it would be too much.
Well, I'll tell you the image that stuck most in my mind this week is the image from the pro-war rally this week, in which Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer shared the stage not only with an openly anti-Semitic pastor, but also with the new GOP House Speaker, Mike Johnson, mere hours, by the way, before he endorsed Donald Trump. Mike Johnson, of course, having been one of the GOP lawmakers who was behind Donald Trump's efforts to steal the 2020 election. And I mean, I feel like this image is so powerfully symbolic because the line from people like Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer and the Democratic leadership more generally is like, you have to vote for us. You don't even have to like us. We may not be able to realize all of your lofty progressive goals like in one election cycle, but look at the other guys. Like,
this is another funny bit of messaging coming out, not from the official Democrats, but from their lackeys and stooges in the media, where it's, listen, if Hitler's running against Mussolini, I gotta vote for Mussolini. Yeah. And it's like, I'm sorry, well, that's not hyping people up.
If it's the same tweet, the one I saw was somebody saying, if there's a choice between Hitler and 1% less Hitler, it is your moral duty to vote for 1% less Hitler.
Hitler.
I mean, I'm not an American. I don't know. I think I would vote for Cornel West in that situation.
But I mean, seriously, like, you have these two senior figures in the Democratic leadership, you know, ranking member in the Senate and ranking member in the House. And there's about to be a presidential election in which the line from the Democratic Party is going to be, you have to vote for our guy, you know, the guy who endorses all of the sentiments that was at this rally, even though he wasn't physically in attendance himself. Because otherwise, the far right demagogue who tried to steal the 2020 election is going to, you know, I don't know, institute fascism in America or something. Anyway, here we are on stage at this pro-war rally with one of his most prominent supporters and literally the ranking member of the Republican Party in the House. I mean, what do you even do with this? It's beyond parody.
I think you're being unfair, because there were actually some really good speakers at that rally. There was the Major from Fawlty Towers did a speech. Adolf Manjou's character from Paths of Glory did a speech about the importance of not cutting and running. I will say, it got a little weird when Harry Lime took the stage and started talking about how, does it really matter if one of those little ants down there stops moving? I thought that was a bit of poor messaging.
The Van Jones thing is so funny to me, because it's like, what rally did Van Jones think he was going to? This guy who's like a former Maoist and now is afflicted with, you know, a chronic form of libitude for which there is no known cure. Anyway, there was this really funny article in Politico this week, which I don't know if you saw it, Will, but basically Politico ran this article. This is by, I guess, their senior political writer, Jonathan Martin. It's called Here's How Biden Can Turn It Around. Did you see this?
Yes, I did see it.
This article is a lot of fun. I wrote about it this week. And I do want to say, just, you know, Jonathan Martin does largely appear to be the messenger here. I mean, he apparently canvassed, you know, dozens of Democratic and also never Trump Republican operatives and strategists and stuff. And what's so funny about this is not like necessarily the suggestions themselves about what Biden should do. It's that none of the strategic advice matches with the other strategic advice. It's this kind of like choose your own adventure, like fan fiction, pundit fantasy football. Like, you know, when you're making a fantasy sports team, you can be like, all right, I'm going to have like the best offense, but also, what if I had the best defense as well, and also the best goalie? Like, it's just, you invent a team that can't actually exist in real life. So, you know, the piece is basically just this kind of smorgasbord of different ideas and strategies. And, you know, don't want to make fun of Jonathan Martin too much, because, yeah, these are things he's apparently solicited from other people. But basically, he writes, the 2024 election will be an extraordinary election. It demands extraordinary measures. Okay, fair enough. So what are the extraordinary measures? Well, the piece recommends that Biden should, quote, smother Joe Manchin with kindness and keep him in the Democratic tent. Joe Manchin, of course, is now flirting with the idea of a no-label-sponsored third-party presidential run to reclaim the middle, which, of course, as we all know, has been horribly lost under the leadership of Joe Biden. Joe Manchin should be smothered with kindness, and also Biden should attempt to, quote, woo Manchin's Republican friend and third-party temptress Mitt Romney, so that both of these men can, quote, actively make the case that voting for Biden is the only way to block Trump. Now, I love this, because what's being described here is literally the strategy that lost Hillary Clinton the 2016 election. It's like, run as the candidate who represents the establishments of both parties. That's never gone wrong before. There's an amazing sentence where Martin writes, like, what seems like tones of just, like, anguished disbelief. Why is Biden not doing more to secure the support of Liz Cheney, who could, quote, bring other prominent figures with her, including her father, Dick Cheney, and former President George W. Bush? So again, just redoing Hillary Clinton's strategy from 2016. Now, what's amazing, though, is it's not too many paragraphs later before the strategic advice turns to Biden should lash his opponent as, you know, a fake populist who, quote, so regularly sides with the wealthy, which, you know, if we're just talking about purely theoretical advice, is not a bad strategy for any Democratic presidential candidate, right? That's what Barack Obama did with Mitt Romney in 2012, talking about his background in finance and, you know, laying people off and stuff, presiding over, you know, corporate austerity. And it worked.
Does that article, which I didn't read, does it mention anything about abortion? Because, of course, I read Etta Germettum's sort of rebuttal to that article.
I read that, too. And honestly, I think that piece is very good, and it's a better one than the one I'm just reading from. But a number of the things he recommends, honestly, are recommended in this piece. It's just that this piece also contains a whole bunch of, like, completely ridiculous suggestions that dilute any force it might have. So, yes, it does mention abortion, and it rightly points out, I think it's the best section of the piece, that if you look at, you know, down ballot races, you know, special elections, midterms, abortion really is an electoral albatross for the Republican Party. I don't want to give him any credit here, but Donald Trump actually is more pragmatic about this. Like, he clearly understands that this is not a winning issue. And at his rallies, he often tries to kind of caution against going too hard on the issue.
He's funny in a lot of ways. Like, the stuff that he says about Israel now, he made that one comment where it's like, there's nothing like the hatred that Palestinians have for Israelis and vice versa.
But then he qualifies that by saying, and maybe it's vice versa. I guess we'll see, or yeah, something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, which already puts him, you know, on the left of Joe Biden on that issue.
But no, Martin does say that, you know, Democrats should run on abortion. And of course, the Republican position on abortion is not helped by the fact that social conservatives are so powerful, you know, right-wing Christian evangelicals so powerful in the Republican Party that, you know, before Mike Pence suspended his presidential campaign, you know, he was running as their tribune. And he was just going to every debate being like, yeah, we need a national abortion ban, which is interesting in and of itself, right? Because the whole Republican talking point after Roe v. Wade was overturned was like, oh, we're just sending it back to the states, right? Because this is a state issue. The states can decide. The federal government should have no role in this. And then now that, like, states like Ohio are codifying reproductive rights in their constitutions, they're like, oh, no, no, we actually need a federal ban on this. But yeah, there's some other fun stuff in this article. One idea is that Rahm Emanuel should be brought back to chair the campaign. So having said that, Biden should run like a quasi-populist campaign that's attacking Trump as a billionaire and all this kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, to run that, let's get the poster boy for like 90s triangle. And I'm sure he'll be really enthusiastic about that strategy. I'm sure the guy whose entire strategy that he pioneered for the Democratic Party was like finding former CIA operatives and troops and FBI people to like run in the 2006 midterms. I'm sure he'll be crazy about using class warfare to defeat Donald Trump.
So a lot of passing it on to the next generation in this article, clearly.
Well, yeah. And speaking of which, I mean, the best suggestion in the article, my personal favorite.
I already know who it's going to be.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, baby. but I'll preface this by saying that earlier in the article, again, you know, Martin writes something that's quite correct. I mean, there's a few good points made in this article, and presumably this is coming from Democratic operatives who are worried about losing their jobs. But like, Biden should ditch Bidenomics because it's really stupid to just keep trying to get people to eat their vegetables and like get really on board with this slogan that represents something most people don't really understand. They don't really feel in their daily lives when the cost
of
living.
They just know that the price of the pumps is a lot higher than it used to be.
Right, exactly. So there's no point like bludgeoning people as various pundits have been doing in the last few months. We talked about that on a recent episode and saying people just don't understand how good Bidenomics is. But something else that's correct in the piece is Martin is very clear. Biden shouldn't repeat Hillary Clinton's mistakes. Like, the piece makes the case that lots of people know who Donald Trump is and they don't care. So scolding is not like a good tactic. And you think, oh, that sounds pretty reasonable. But then also elsewhere in the article, I think a little bit before that, we get the suggestion, my personal favorite, that both Bill and Hillary Clinton should be appointed as high-level envoys to preside over a new peace process in the Middle East.
It's funny that he mentioned Bill. You don't see much of him anymore.
Gee, I wonder why. There's a good part where Biden is supposed to, quote, lay down a message on immigration and the border. It's not really clear what that message should be. He should just have a message. There's a really weird bit. I mean, this is another issue with this article that makes it very strange, is like the scale of the different things being suggested, like, oscillates kind of so wildly from like there should be a completely different messaging strategy to things like this, where like there's this really perplexing part where Martin writes, while most Americans recoil from Trump's vow to shoot shoplifters in the back, they are also alarmed by videos of stores being looted in cities across the country. Why aren't the president or vice president linking arms with store owners, employees, and police departments? Then there's like some stuff which I didn't even include in my write-up on this because it seemed too trivial, where it's like, we need to have Biden in different settings. Like, he should be in like a casino surrounded by like Hispanic casino workers, and like,
let's put him in a cowboy hat. Wouldn't we like to see that?
He could talk about his love for hot sauce. Now he always keeps some in his pocket and has for decades. I was a little perplexed about what to say about any of this because, yeah, like, in some, it doesn't really add up to anything coherent. It's like Biden is supposed to run for re-election by attacking his opponent kind of from the left as an ally of the rich, while also foregrounding his relationships with like the most prominent Never Trump Republicans. He's supposed to go hard to the right on law and order stuff, presumably on immigration as well. He's supposed to avoid Hillary Clinton's mistakes, but he's also supposed to repeat several of the key ones, while also appointing both Clintons as high-level peace envoys. So not very coherent. But then I realized that the key to understanding what's going on in this article, and this is why I actually kind of like the article. I'm not being ironic here. Remember, Martin begins by saying that he canvassed various, you know, factions within the Democratic Party for advice, or within the Democratic coalition. So that includes now, you know, many actual card-carrying lifelong Republicans who don't like Donald Trump. And I think it's a very interesting comment on how incoherent the Democratic coalition really is, that what comes out of that process is something that's just completely incoherent. And I would surmise that if you did the same exercise in the Republican Party, like, yes, you'd get variation. There's a difference between what, like, I don't know, a Kevin McCarthy, like former Tea Party guy, would say is the best way to win an election and what, like, someone from the Freedom Caucus says. But honestly, they're all kind of on board with the same project. And you wouldn't get these, like, wild variations. Like, in the Republican Party, you wouldn't get one group who says, oh, we should just never talk about abortion, and actually we should be kind of pro-choice, and then another group that's like, no, we should have a federal ban. Like, they would have not only message discipline on that, but they would have, like, ideological coherence on it as well. And so that ultimately is my reading of the article. Its incoherence is less a statement on this writer from Politico than it is about all the different people he talked to and the bizarre coalition to which they belong. Now, look, there's no good way to segue out of all of that.
Oh, I know a way. Uh-huh. Wouldn't, in the midst of all this strife and turmoil, all this death and carnage, wouldn't it be nice to retreat to childhood? Because that's what we're going to do now. Let's just get our little bottles and our little baby blanket. Let's have our mother, you know, cradle us and burp us and put us to bed. And let's watch Mouse Hunt.
The Smunt brothers have inherited their father's old house. There's only one small problem. The mouse is in the house.
It's just a mouse.
Mouse Hunt, rated PG, starts Friday, December 19th.
Yeah, that's right, folks. It's Mouse Hunt. I mentioned it offhandedly on the last episode. There was a surprisingly vociferous response from some people in the comments on Patreon.
And so, Luke, there was no discussion. Luke commandeered... No,
this was an executive decision.
He commandeered the Michael and us group DM and said, we're doing Mouse Hunt on this episode. And I thought, you know, maybe I need to get aggressive like this too. Why do I go through this, like, debate? And why do I humor Luke when I suggest something? He goes, well, maybe. What are we feeling this week? Let's look at Netflix. You know, like, what I need to do is take the bull by the horns. You know, be the Nathan Lane to your Lee Evans. And impose... idiotic ideas like this too. But no, it wasn't idiotic, because I had a good time watching Mouse Hunt.
Oh my god, I had so much fun watching this movie. I expected this was going to be one of those things where, you know, I did love this movie as a kid. I must have seen it a zillion times. I remember my friend Giles, I used to go over to his house, and he had an N64, and he had GoldenEye, and he had Diddy Kong Racing. I think he had Mario 64.
Paradise.
Oh my god, absolutely. He had Mortal Kombat, and I remember sometimes we'd get his older brother to come in because we were really bad at it, and we'd be like, Mark, can you, like, get us up to one of the kings so, like, what we can see what they're like? Because we could never get, like, past, like, the third guy or whatever, even on, like, the lowest difficulty. But anyway, I'm pretty sure Giles' mom put, like, hard limits on how much Nintendo we were allowed to play. But there was always time for Mouse Hunt, okay? So, and good thing, too.
Some key differences between you and me. I saw Mouse Hunt... I think not even once. I remember watching it at the before and after school program, which, you know, school let out at 3:30. And
but your parents didn't want you, so you stayed.
Yeah, they didn't want me.
Wait, what? I don't actually know. What do you mean before and after?
Well,
program?
School lets out at 3:30, but a lot of parents get off work at 5.
Right.
And so there'd be a daycare program after school where the latchkey kids like myself were too young to just go home on our own. I would have been in, like, third grade, probably. And there were, most of my friends were in this.
And they would wheel, like, a TV into the classroom on one of those carts that only exists for, like, public schools.
100%. Yeah. And every month there'd be, like, movie day, you know, movie Friday. And on one of those days, it was Mouse Hunt. And I know that I saw at least 2/3 of it. And then I guess my parents came and picked me up because I was remembering this scene, that scene, that scene, that scene. And then all of a sudden, I didn't remember anything anymore. So now I've seen it from beginning to end. No sentimental attachment to this movie. When you said you wanted to do it, I thought, really? And
how wrong were you?
And also because there is a particular genre of episode that we do that you are really enthusiastic about. And I sometimes like, but it's not my favorite, which is the get a 90s piece of mass popular entertainment, preferably a children's movie, and project ideology onto it.
No, it's not projecting. It's extracting the ideology. It's finding.
If you say so.
I don't project anything into these movies. I simply come across it.
Yeah, you know, you're a regular Zizek, you know, you're Adam Curtis over here.
No, this is, we're putting on our They Live glasses and we're watching, just think about, I mean, you say these
this
episodes
aren't
your favorite.
This is going to pose a greater challenge than some of them, though, I think.
I know you've already
got a reading.
I disagree. I have several readings. But okay, but...
The mouse is the return of the repressed. Okay.
Save it. But okay, I didn't have before and after time or whatever at my elementary school. The equivalent for me was the snow days, because it was a fully bus school. And so, like, if there was any snow at all, I guess for insurance reasons, not any snow, but if there was, like, school would frequently be canceled in, like, pretty mild conditions. And then sometimes it would not be canceled in conditions that were pretty bad. And I would have, like, the worst disappointment of my life sitting at the radio waiting to hear the name of my school as one of the ones that was canceled. It was always last because the school was Zora Highland Park Public School. I feel like the movie that was sort of the go-to, I mean, it was like episodes of Bill Nye the Science Guy, which were also shown in science class, probably long after they should have been, but yeah. I always have fun with Bill Nye.
No, seriously, as late as like grade 10, I was seeing those videos.
It was genuinely heartwarming to see him on the picket lines recently during the strike.
Oh, that's great. And by the way, as long as they played those videos deep into being a teenager, we were all happy to see them.
Oh, yeah. No, the big movie, I think, was like The Emperor's New Groove. I feel like I saw that movie like 200 times. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like the specter of youth and childhood is kind of looming over this episode. So let's stay on this for a moment. Because I was thinking about my elementary school days recently, and I was reflecting on how ridiculous it was that school ended. I think for me, a lot of time, it was at 3:15. And, you know, I had this friend called Matt, who was one of the first, like his house was one of the first stops. He was on my school bus, and sometimes I'd go over to his house after school. And so you'd be at home at like 3:30. And for reasons I can't remember, I was thinking about that in retrospect. 3:30 is just the middle of the day. And it'd be like, all right.
That's why we had the before and after school at my school.
Right. All right. So Mouse Hunt, definitely a much funnier movie than I remembered or than I thought it was going to be.
Thumbs up. It was funny. A lot of my kind of comedy.
It was not well reviewed at the time. Roger Ebert gave it 2 stars.
So sight unseen, I haven't read a single one of the reviews, but I think there's a certain kind of middle class. Class, middle brow, fusty, medium smart newspaper critic who's like, ooh, I'm above slapstick. You know, I like the witty comedy of Andy Borowitz in The New Yorker. But none of this falling off ladders and doing pratfalls. And to that I say, this is the stuff of life. This is the most elemental kind of comedy. Nathan Lane and Lee Evans in a tub that like falls down the stairs.
Has a cardboard naked lady in it.
Yeah, it like goes down the stairs and it propels clear out of the house down a mountain, and the close-up shots of them like screaming, going ah! Like that to me is so funny. I love that kind of comedy.
So if people don't know Mouse Hunt, I'm sure many millennials listening, you will remember this movie. You maybe have some relationship to it yourself.
90s kids remember.
God, I mean, I hate that I just did that, but yeah, 90s kids probably do remember. If you're a Zoomer listener, you might not have seen Mouse Hunt. This is basically, I don't know, yeah, a slapstick children's comedy from 1997.
Kind of a Laurel and Hardy for the 90s. You got a funny guy and you got another funny guy, and together they're funny.
Well, yeah, one of them thinks of himself as smart and the other is dumb, and that's their kind of dynamic.
And it's a real throwback to like Laurel and Hardy, The Three Stooges, that kind of, you know, old-timey slapstick.
The other 90s movie that this film is deeply indebted to is Home Alone, because if you're not familiar with the plot, which, you know, we're going to go through, this film is kind of like a remake of Home Alone, which is told from the point of view of Joe Pesci.
Luke looked at me confused because he couldn't remember the name of the other guy. Daniel Stern is his name.
That's right. Who, as you pointed out, is also the rock star who tries to buy art from Max von Sydow and Hannah and her sisters.
And that's why I'm the film guy on this podcast, because I can be depended on for facts like, what is Daniel Stern's name?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
This is why I got my degree in film studies.
Yeah, later in the movie, Nathan Lane's character says something about, like, he says to some sheik or something, oh, Hakuna Matata, which in addition to being a very politically politically incorrect joke you couldn't put in a movie now. Will also was like, that's a little Easter egg, because of course Nathan Lane, he plays Timon in The Lion King.
Again, I am the new Roger Ebert.
Yeah, Will's brain is basically the warehouse at the end of Indiana Jones, where they put the Ark of the Covenant. File folders with other file folders inside them. And he went over to the big Nathan Lane box, opened it up, went a few layers deeper, and found a file that just said Nathan Lane, Timon, and Pumbaa. And, you know, he accessed that file and ran it. And that's why he's the film guy on this podcast. But so Mouse Hunt is very much in the tradition of Home Alone. So the mouse is Kevin McAllister. The two ostensibly leading characters in the movie, they're kind of more like anti-heroes. The mouse is more the audience surrogate character, even though it's not introduced until some way through, I guess, towards the end of Act One.
Well, Nathan Lane and Lee Evans are kind of lost souls in a way. They're good men, basically, deep down, but they need something, perhaps a mouse, to kind of guide them back to what true values are.
Now that I'm thinking about it, they should remake Home Alone, just like the exact same movie, but with Kevin McAllister reimagined as kind of like a force of nature.
Yeah, I would like to see a Home Alone, like Home Alone 4 or 5 or whatever number we're at, where it's like the cycle of trauma continues, and now Kevin McAllister is like robbing houses, and he's played, by the way, by Macaulay Culkin. As he looks now. No disrespect to Macaulay if he's listening. You never know.
But so if you're not familiar with Mouse Hunt, that's kind of the plot. There's lots of hijinks, and you know, the mouse inflicts horrific violence on these two brothers. The film opens with a funeral where the two brothers are carrying their father's coffin. You know, we can already tell they don't exactly like each other. Nathan Lane is telling the other guy that you can't even wear a black suit to our dad's funeral. That's the grayest black I've ever seen. The argument is soon interrupted as they drop the coffin and their father's corpse goes flying directly into an open manhole cover. So that's letting you all know, like, strap yourselves in. Some hijinks are going to ensue. Then the credits roll. You pointed out this is a DreamWorks production, an early DreamWorks production.
Well, I do find that interesting because, so 1993, Steven Spielberg releases Jurassic Park and Schindler's List. No one has ever been more powerful than that. Mm-hmm. That's mojo right there. He's the most popular pop artist in the world, as well as a respected serious artist. And he's like, now is the time to build my own movie studio. And he hooks up with David Geffen and Jeffrey Katzenberg, and they make DreamWorks, which is the first new major movie studio in decades. And this was the third DreamWorks production. The first was The Peacemaker, an action movie with George Clooney and Nicole Kidman.
No idea what that is.
The second one was Amistad. That was Steven Spielberg's movie about slavery. Another early one was Ants.
Oh, yeah.
The Woody Allen classic.
Well, okay, that's another movie where I saw it as a kid and like it did kind of freak me out. Do you remember the scene where the ants try to ambush the termite colony and then they get ambushed? And it's like horrific violence, even though it's CGI. Like you watch that movie as a kid and you're thinking like, oh, this is like A Bug's Life. It's like a cute Pixar movie about bugs that talk to each other.
But no, it's about a neurotic, ephebophile ant.
It's like, what if Woody Allen was in Apocalypse Now?
But yeah, you look at the list of DreamWorks productions as a goes along and it's like, yeah, Shrek 2, Shark Tale, Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate
Events.
Is
Finding Nemo DreamWorks?
No, that's Disney Pixar. Oh,
excuse
How fucking
me.
Dare yeah. you? Shark Tale is DreamWorks. And I don't know, it's kind of like, you look at this, it's like, was having a movie studio worth it? I mean, if I were Steven Spielberg, and please, if you're listening, Steve, call me up. Just have a little boutique operation, make good movies, you know?
Make Mouse Hunt. So yeah, the movie opens with this kind of credit sequence that's like bits of string and like, you know, various letters hanging from bits of string.
Well, it's a very Tim Burton-esque opening credit sequence. And in fact, director Gore Verbinski, later of Pirates of the Caribbean fame, I do think takes more than a few little nuggets of wisdom out of the Tim Burton Little Red Book. It's full of Burton-esque production design. It's kind of like 60% of the way to being a Tim Burton looking movie. And much like, you know, a movie like Batman or something, it takes place in a sort of nowhere land.
Oh, man.
In terms of time.
I love that. The movie seems to be kind of set in the 90s in that one character at one point refers to like bringing something into the 21st century. But honestly, honestly, it feels more like the 1950s, but it's not quite the 1950s either.
And
it
I like that. And I like it.
And again, it's because it's folks, it's the 1990s. So we're in post-historical epoch.
It's like Dark City.
It's exactly like Dark City.
And by the way, I just want to say the big string factory in the movie, I think, looks really cool.
Oh man, the string factory looks amazing. So we learn that the two brothers, not only do they not get along, they did not get along particularly well with their father, who was a string magnate who came over from the old world with nothing but a little piece of string in his pocket, which he's given them on their deathbed. And he said, you know, I've been carrying this with me in my pocket for 50 years. My sons, you must keep it as my most treasured possession. But they're talking to the, I don't know, the guy who's in charge of the will or whatever. And, you know, they learn that they've inherited their father's string business, his string factory. They get his ceramic egg, his collection of spoons, and his, you know, half empty box of Cuban cigars, or half full, if you ask me. But then as they're leaving, it turns out that there's also some kind of dilapidated property valued at only $50,000 that they've never heard of, which their father took as payment for a loan at some point in the past. We then see Ernie, the Nathan Lane character, at the restaurant he works at, where he seems to be both the head chef and the maitre d'.
And the minute you see people like preparing food, you know, preparing luxury cuisine in the kitchen, you know, it's like when somebody in a Three Stooges short is like, now, boys, I've prepared these 500 cream pies, and I need you to bring them all to the fancy society party. You know, shenanigans are about to ensue.
Yeah, so he's like affects like a bit of a French persona as he's dealing with the upper crust guests, one of whom is the mayor a day before the mayor's re-election.
Oh no, not the day before the mayor's re-election.
Yeah. Ernie, the Nathan Lane character, is very much a sort of an aspiring, you know, ladder climber. He seems a lot more interested in those pursuits than his brother, who, you know, despite having been born into this string magnate's fortune, doesn't seem to be driven or ambitious in the same way. But so there's an extremely disgusting scene in which a cockroach crawls into, you know, the exquisite meal he's about to serve to Mayor McCrinkle.
And the cockroach is representative of capitalism.
I don't really know what the cockroach represents, but I do know that the following scene is both hilarious and disgusting, because there's like a scene where like one of the kids of the mayor notices the cockroach and is like, oh my God, it's a cockroach. And then the other kid says, wait, that's only half a cockroach. Daddy, you ate the head. So yeah, then the mayor like vomits up the cockroach's head. It's disgusting. The mayor is taken off in an ambulance. We learn later that he dies, which is honestly pretty funny.
I do like a movie like this that has a body count. Like,
yes.
Wouldn't it have been nice if just once, when Mo was hitting Larry with a sledgehammer, he actually bashed his fucking skull in?
The Mo does a mass shooting.
You see Larry on the ground and his face, his skull is literally bashed in, and Curly saying, Mo, you killed Larry. What are we going to do with the body? Shut up, Chowderhead. We got to get this out of here, or I'll kill you next, you knucklehead.
Yeah, Larry tries to double cross Mo, but then like takes one in the dome. And then the movie ends at a Mexican standoff where it's just Mo, Shemp, and I don't know, some side character, and then it cuts to black and you just hear three gunshots simultaneously.
Jesse Plemons comes to Moe's house and says, Mr. Howard, I've come from Washington, D.C. to investigate the disappearance of all these stooges.
You smell something?
Smells like gas.
But so Shay Ernie is condemned. This all happens very quickly. Lars, the other brother, goes to eat at a restaurant, or rather like a kind of a seedy diner, where it turns out Ernie is now working. Ernie's carrying himself like, this is only temporary. Soon I'm going to be back on top. There's a pretty funny scene early on where, I know, two guys who apparently represent like Big String come and try to buy the factory. You know, it's like these two goons wearing fedoras, and they're like, yeah, you know, you don't make string by winding two strands together anymore. You know, multiple strings is the past, single strings is the future. We'll cut you in. We're gonna bring your string factory into the 21st century.
And again, I like this about this movie. I like that it is playing in like, you know, old Three Stooges archetypes, basically, like the gangster with the fedora. Yeah. You know, the big fat mayor with the mustache.
But Lars takes one look at the piece of string, and you know, there's like a flashback to his father's deathbed, and the dad, you know, like coughing and wheezing with his final breath. breaths is saying, like, my sons promise me you'll never sell Schultz string to one of those big conglomerates.
And by the way, to the extent that this movie has politics, which debatable, but that...
Oh, I disagree.
Well, okay, but like that's one of those key 90s things. It's like all those movies from the 90s, like Wayne's World, for instance, one of the central conflicts is always like, we're not gonna sell out to the man.
Or do you remember like Jumanji? There's like the shoe factory, which then like Carl, that like worker, is gonna innovate by inventing the sneaker. And then like the kid who like Robin Williams plays in when he's an adult ruins the invention. And then like 20 years later, the town is in ruins.
Like another 90s movie, another DreamWorks production, American Beauty. Mm-hmm. What's that all about? It's like we've got unlimited prosperity and yet we're empty. We're empty inside. We are king. We're living in this great fucking upper middle class house and yet I'm empty.
But what if we smoked weed?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know.
What if we thought like Mina Savari was attractive?
Yeah, there are things in the movie that you could say have not aged well. That's what unites so many of these movies from the 90s. Wayne's World or something. It's like we could sell out because that's within our grasp. Prosperity is here. Prosperity is everywhere. It's within our grasp. But when we achieve prosperity, do we lose our souls?
That's right. So the next thing we see, the two brothers are walking in the street. There is a wee bit of ideology in this scene because Nathan Lane sees this homeless guy and he's like sleeping in the street. Pathetic. And then the homeless guy's like, if I had a house, I'd sleep in it. Then a few moments later, they look into a bakery window, and it's Epstein's Bakery, which I think is interesting here.
Well, I mean, Stanley Kubrick did direct this film, so...
Yeah, this was actually where the sets from Eyes Wide Shut came from.
Yeah, that kind of dreamlike, otherworldly studio quality, yeah.
But so they go to see this house, which they think, oh, whatever, we'll hawk it for $50,000. You know, you think the tension in the movie is going to be like, are they going to sell the string factory and defy their dying father, who they're estranged from? Are they going to thwart his dying wish? But they go to the house and I don't know, some hijinks ensue. They get hurt a little bit. They go up to the attic and they find a blueprint up there, which has the date 1876 and the name of the architect, one Charles Lyle LaRue. So then it cuts to some guy at the, like, I don't know, local municipal bureau who's found the name Charles Lyle LaRue. And wouldn't you know it, turns out Charles Lyle LaRue, a famous architect. The house is soon full of rich people who are collectors, connoisseurs of LaRue's architecture. It turns out this house is the fabled missing LaRue that LaRue is rumored to have designed and maybe even built before he was committed to an asylum. Various people show up to try to buy the house. The most prominent is one Mr. Falco, who is, I would say, the most underdeveloped character in the film. The film tries to give him some little, I don't know, characteristics. Like he's always asking his henchmen for like a vegetarian snack or something. I don't really think he's very well fleshed out. But so Ernie, who's the more acquisitive and ambitious of the two brothers, says, you know, I'm not going to take your money right here. I could never do anything so crass, but you'd be welcome to come to the auction. So the idea is let's get these people to come and outbid each other. And that basically is the end of Act One. Now, Act Two.
God damn, this is taking a long time.
Well, there's a lot
Act Two. Let me streamline this.
There's a lot of layers to this movie. Will.
Let me streamline this. Act Two, there's a mouse. And they're trying to repair this house. They're trying to do a big reno in a really short amount of time and make it saleable.
There's so much funny shit in this.
We don't have to say every single.
No, but some of the gags are genuinely good. Like, they become.
Give me your top two.
Shut the fuck up, man. I'm going to give you my top, however many I want.
I'm thinking of the listener. We're going to bore the listener just being like, and then this happened, yeah, and then no, this no. happened, and then this happened, and then this happened.
We're not going to go through every gag in the movie, but there is some genuinely funny stuff here. Like, they become so single-mindedly obsessed with killing this mouse. There's a really funny scene early on where they're both in different rooms, and they're chasing the mouse. Ernie finds a broom, Lars finds a hammer, and then it's like shots of them each, like, maniacally, like, running towards the other. I don't know. Of course, they hit each other with both of them. There's a really funny thing where Lars is just, he's hit Ernie on the head with the broom, and then he's just like looking in horror at the broken broom handle. That kind of
All
thing
right,
kills
those
me.
Those are your top two, and then my number one is whole room full of mouse traps. Chain reaction goes off. The mouse traps are setting each other off. Uh-oh. Nathan Lane and Lee Evans are at the other side
That's
of the
right.
room.
That's right. There's a lot about fate in this movie. You know, it's very derivative.
Oh, God. Do you hear yourself?
It's also very derivative of, you know, the Coen brothers. You know, you think about...
Okay, now, think, no, think, I'm shutting this
you
down.
Think about the mouse knocking the cherry onto the...
I'm registering my disapproval now. I'm not party to this.
When the mouse knocks the cherry over to set off all the mouse traps, and there's that incredibly tense shot of like the cherry spinning in one place, and then, you know, the stem ultimately lands on the traps and sets it all off. You know, that's like Llewyn Davis coming out of the Gaslight Cafe and seeing a young Bob Dylan on stage.
Yeah,
it's kind of like, or if not for a simple twist of fate.
Yeah, or like the ring in Match Point. I getcha. There's worth mentioning the Christopher Walken character. He's an exterminator. he has some trouble, you know?
Yeah, Christopher Walken shows up and is immediately, and honestly, very, very good performance. Doesn't have many lines, but Christopher Walken is basically an exterminator who takes his job very, very seriously. He says, you know, most people are not psychologically prepared to deal with a mouse. He's got all this gadgets and like all this gear. He's basically like in Alien, like towards the end where the captain goes like below deck with the flamethrower. And if you're watching the movie for the first time, you're like, all right, you know, the captain's pretty competent. Like, I'm sure he'll take care of the alien. And the mouse very much is like the alien in this movie because it handily defeats even Christopher Walken's practiced competence. And he is, you know, violently dragged down the stairs. You know, half the house is destroyed in the process. Again, very, very funny.
Well, the mouse is the return to the repressed. Oh, sorry, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
One other thing in Act 2 that I think is worth pointing out is when they first get to the house, there's only one bed and they decide to flip a coin. This is also, you know, it's also a bit of a Coen Brothers metaphysics operating here. Or maybe this is symbolic, you know, I'm wearing my They Live glasses, so maybe this is symbolic of, you know, the 1990s and, you know, the end of ideology, because the coin spins on the ground and then it lands on its side. It doesn't fall one way or the other.
No left, no right. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, Act 3, they think they've got rid of the mouse. It's all gone. They've somehow, after destroying the whole house, been able to get it back up into working order for the big auction. They have people from Japan, people from Saudi Arabia. They've got all the richest of the rich of the rich. And when you got all those people in a room, you just know that the Three Stooges are about to come in with a whole crate of Fabergé eggs and they're going to drop them everywhere. Well, that doesn't quite happen here, but something similar happens. The mouse is back, folks. He finds his way back in. There is slapstick shenanigans when during the auction, the mouse is like getting everywhere. He's getting down a lady's top. He's getting down Lee Evans' suit.
His pants.
Nathan Lane has to take off Lee Evans' pants.
That was really... He doesn't take them off. He just like undoes his fly and like puts his entire arm into his pants.
Yeah.
And then there's a full 30 seconds where it's like, have you got it?
And
it's pretty funny.
The mouse, it is funny, honestly. And the mouse, just chaos. Everybody's leaving. Lee Evans, by the way, Lee Evans is gold digging almost
his ex-wife. Hussy wife.
That shrew. She came because, ooh, she thinks there's money here, but then she immediately left with some rich Texan.
But as all this chaos is unfolding, she does leave with the Texan. But the bids are just going higher and higher. So you think, you know, the bids are up to like $25, $27 million. But then the doofus brothers, in their single-minded obsession with ending the mouse ends up running to some hole in the wall. Nathan Lane puts a hose in there and is like, when I give you the signal, turn it on full blast. Then, of course, like, the handle breaks off and, yeah, the house floods, everybody runs out, and then Nathan Lane is like, no, this just proves the missing LaRue is indestructible, will never fall down. And then, yeah, the entire house just, like, explodes, which, again, is pretty funny.
Got a laugh out of me, too. But ultimately, they learn, and the mouse teaches them that there are more important things than just cashing in
on their father's estate. There is a twist ending and an epilogue, which I honestly didn't remember at all. It does complicate the movie a bit.
It kind of foreshadows Ratatouille, because we find out that the mouse basically teaches them how to make string cheese.
It follows them back to the factory, and you think, maybe this is setting up Mouse Hunt 2. But then, no... It puts some cheese into one of the string machines, which then like pushes out this perfectly crafted ball of string, but made out of cheese. The next thing you see, they turn the whole factory into a cheese string factory. All the workers who've been very discontented throughout the movie, they go on strike at one point. Although I do think the movie is on the side of labor. It's on the side of the working man. At the end, you see the factory, and yeah, they've invented the cheese string. Everything is prospering. I mean, it's on the side of the working man in that very 1990s way, where it's like, we can save jobs, but only through innovation. And so yeah, at the end of the day, the mouse has actually done them a favor, which is pretty incredible and complicates both of my readings of the movie.
Well, it's time, Luke. What are both of your readings?
Well, I think the key... I think the key...
And I say, why only two?
I think the key thing about this movie that like drives all of the gags and the humor is like, why are they so obsessed with chasing this mouse? Like, they're about to sell the house for potentially like $25 million. Like, they could just let whatever like zillionaire buys the house, just let them deal with the fucking rodent infestation. Doesn't matter. But in the course of trying to catch the mouse, they inflict like severe damage on the property. And if anything, they reduce its value. Their pursuit of the mouse actually proves to be self-defeating. But so yeah, there is this like tacked on happy ending or whatever, because at the end of the day in the 90s, it's like, we're all middle class now. We're all going to succeed. We can't really imagine failure, except, you know, there's that one homeless guy we see in the movie. But it seems to me most of the movie is about how, yeah, the pursuit of the mouse is ultimately self-defeating. So yeah, the mouse represents how the pursuit of money and success, how the, you know, the ethos of self-maximization that defines the neoliberal zenith of the 1990s is ultimately self-defeating. That was at least my reading until a conversation the two brothers have some way through Act Two, when they really go into their relationship with their father and how, you know, Ernie is saying, you know, on his birthday, I cooked him like the best meal that I'd ever made. I slaved over that, but he didn't even notice. He just noticed the string that I'd wrapped it in, or that I'd used to tie up the meat or something. It was never good enough.
To that, I say Rosebud.
Yeah, the piece of string is literally Rosebud. But I don't know, this scene, I think, lends itself to more of a Freudian reading, where the mouse actually represents a kind of displaced patriarchal authority. Like, the mouse represents their father, you know, from the grave. They're still trying to impress him, even though it's ultimately a fruitless quest. And actually, now I'm coming around to, I think the end of the movie makes a lot more sense now.
He's because, cooking, folks.
Yeah, because this is a 90s movie, and fundamentally, the movie achieves a perfect ideological synthesis at the end, okay? Because their father asks them, don't ever sell the string factory to a big conglomerate. But the string factory also represents like the old. It's an anachronism, right? We don't need a string factory anymore, especially with this single strand bullshit. So what do they do?
Like, you know, you can get your string digitally now.
That's
like
right.
Your phone can be string for you.
Yeah, string is non-fungible. Although honestly, I'm dubious on that. It just seems like another one of these, you know, risky speculative investments. I wouldn't recommend it, folks. But so, you know, they don't sell the factory, but they innovate it. And so the film not only resolves every tension that has sustained it hitherto, it effaces the very idea of tension, and thus earns its status as one of the defining pieces of cinema of the 1990s.
Sorry, Taste of Cherry.
Mr. Trouble never hangs around when he hears this mighty sound.
Here I come to save the day.
That means that Mighty Mouse is on the way. Yes, sir, when there is a wrong to right, Mighty Mouse will join the fight. On the sea or on the land, he gets the situation well in hand.